comes the sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right. Here comes the sun.
Everybody, welcome to Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. This is Eric Mann, your host. I'm in studio with Channing Martinez, our producer. I want to thank our friends at Feminist Magazine that starts at 2. So if you just tuned in, next week tune in at 2 so you can see, listen to the Feminist Magazine and then go and listen to Voices from the Front Lines at 3 in our new slot. So what we're going to do today, sisters and brothers, ladies and gentlemen, is that we're going to start with a review of a film called The Dressmaker with Kate Winslet that came out in 2015 and a little bit in 2016. Then I'm going to just discuss this question of what are we all going to do about looking in the mirror about the politics? Everybody is very clear, it seems. Everybody knows what's wrong with Trump, what's wrong with the Democrats, what's wrong with Bernie, what's wrong with everybody. But do we ever ask what's wrong with ourselves? What are we doing? What could we do better? What mistakes are we making? In the organizing world, you look in the mirror all the time if you're a good organizer. I'm not sure that in the world, in your psychological life, you better look in the mirror too. So I'm going to do some looking in the mirror. I'm going to tell you what the Democrats should do in looking in the mirror and what Trump should do and what Bernie and what Jill should do. Then I'll tell you some of the looking in the mirror that I'm doing. And then we're going to go to the phones, 818-985-5735, and you're going to tell me what you have done wrong and what you plan to do better. How's that? Not what's wrong with anybody else but yourself. And then areas where you're feeling good and something you think you've improved upon. You get it? So it's introspection, look in the mirror, errors, mistakes you think you've made recently, and correctives that you're trying to make, and I will try to lead that, and Channing Martinez will as well. So you got the game plan, so The Dressmaker, then looking in the mirror, then going to the phone so you can look in the mirror too. So again, I'm Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Front Lines. I love film, and I love film reviews. And by reviews, I mean to review a film. The film I want to tell you about, it's an interesting film. Also, one more thing. I don't always review films that were just in the theater. In the age of Netflix and Hulu and Amazon Prime and whatever, you can get any film at any time. So if I see a film is great and it's 7 years old, I'd rather talk about it than, or if I saw it on Netflix, I'd rather talk about it than something in the theater. The other day, my wife, Leanne, and I, we went to the Grove and we saw 7 films on the thing and we wouldn't want to watch any of them. So we just walked away. So often I don't want to review something in the theater because there ain't nothing necessarily good in the theater. Okay. So, all right, The Dressmaker. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just read you the credits, as I always do. Thank you, Channing. Then I'm going to just read a review that I didn't agree with, but it'll just give you a short review from the Newsday, and I'll give you my review. All right, so The Dressmaker was released in the United States October 29, 2015, directed by Jocelyn Morehouse, written by Rosalie Hamm from a novel, and P.J. Hogan. Featured actors are Kate Winslet, who is the lead, who plays a dressmaker, her mom, Judy Davis, the Mad Hatter, and Liam Hemsworth. So the storyline is a glamorous woman returns to a small town in rural Australia. I believe Kate Winslet is from Australia. With a sewing machine and haute couture style, she transformed the women and exacts sweet revenge on those who did her wrong. Okay. That's one version of it. Now I'm going to read you a review. It says, this is from Rafael Guzman in Newsday.com. Just pick one. This off-kilter comedy shines at moments and goes very dark at others, entertaining but highly uneven. The Dressmaker is a movie nearly impossible to categorize. It's a black comedy, a psychological thriller, and a Western spoof all at once. More specifically, it combines three totally unrelated movies. Alfred Hitchcock's Marnie, the Spencer Tracy classic Bad Day at Black Rock, and the camp comedy Kinky Boots. I haven't seen any of those three films. Maybe I'll see all three. The Dressmaker comes close, so close to stitching it all together, blessed with a terrific cast, evocative cinematography by Donald McAlpin, and a plot that's anything but predictable. The Dressmaker can be highly entertaining. It's also, in the end, usually frustrating. I think I'm just going to tell you my own review, because otherwise I'm going to waste a lot of your time listening to this dude's review, and I'll just tell you my own. Because he's going to tell you the plot line in it. Okay. Sure. So Kate Winslet goes back, and she's Tilly Dunnage, who in 1951 returns to her isolated hometown of Dungatar, Australia, which actually I am going to read, which she left under a cloud of suspicion. Now a high-end seamstress, she carries her wooden box singer like a Winchester, ready for a showdown. "I'm back," she growls, lighting a cigarette like a kid glove version of Clint Eastwood's Man with No Name. The plot thickens when we meet her mother, justifiably named Mad Molly, Judy Davis, ferociously good. Both women have memory problems. Did Tilly really kill a fellow classmate as a child? Somehow, by sewing fine dresses for coarse townfolk, Tilly intends to solve her mystery. In addition to this seriously daffy premise, the Dressmaker offers a parade of enjoyable, bizarre Dungatarians. The ugly duckling farm girl, Sarah Snook, the hunchback pharmacist, Barry Otto, the cross-dressing cop, Hugo Weaving, in an endearingly, if slightly stereotypic role. The only level-headed local is handsome Teddy Squinney, a cheerful Liam Hemsworth, who doggedly courts Tilly despite their decade-plus age gap. What mars the potential gem is its zigzagging tone, which changes from farcical to nasty to sorrowful without warning. The grandma with the pot brownies is cute. The drugged rape victim is not. One confrontationally turns shockingly bloody, and a series of deaths in the final act makes the film feel like a tragedy. But when it's over, you may not know exactly what you saw. All right, so let me tell you what exactly you saw and why am I reviewing this kind of weird film. For a lot of you know me, my biggest theme in life, I realize, is genocide. And as a Jew, I began the journey about genocide when I was 2 and 3 as my parents talked to me about it. As a part of the civil rights movement, I've done a great deal of thinking about the United States genocide against black people. As an anti-imperialist, I thought a lot about U.S. genocide against indigenous people in the United States. I wrote a book called Katrina's Legacy, The Black Nation, the People of the World Confront the U.S. Empire and its Genocidal Climate Crimes. So I'm very interested in working on the challenge of genocide. Now, genocide, just to bear with me for a minute, and this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines, 90.7 FM. Genocide is defined by the United Nations statutes, which they developed after World War II. Of course, it means state violence against the people, including death and significant murder and wiping out of a great deal of the population. But it also means a systematic state attack on a people based on race, based on nationality, a degrading treatment of a people, a forced dispersal of a treatment of people, breaking up families, taking children into other ethnic groups. It's got a lot of different elements, many, many of which apply, of course, to the U.S. treatment of black people. But the other part of genocide, which is very important, is that I ask you now, our listeners on Voices from the Frontlines, do you think of the United States as a white settler state? Think about it. When you wake up in the morning, you walk down the street, you say, well, here I am in the middle of the white settler state. I do. I always see the United States as an illegitimate country where the government has constructed a white invasion of Christian Europeans who came here under a capitalist imperialist system and both subjugated and annihilated the native peoples. Now, anytime I see Australia, so thank you for bearing with me on this journey, the first thing when I see Australians, I think, is what a disgusting group of people, the white Australians. They are white settlers. The whole Australia was a British colony that was set up with prisoners who they didn't want, who came into Australia, and the first thing they did is create genocide against the Maori people. So when you see Kate Winslet in The Dressmaker, I see white people who shouldn't be in Australia in the first place. That's what a settler state means. They have no legitimacy in my eyes. So I'm not just, and that's really weird because if you look at a bunch of white people, if you're seeing a film about white people, you don't think of them as being a part of a settler state. They're just being there. But as Harold Cruz said in The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual, the white Americans never came to terms with the country that they conquered. They've never been at peace with it. They've had contempt even for the land, not just for the people. So now you go into this weird white Australian community in which Kate Winslet comes back. She's been very successful as a seamstress, as a designer in Paris, but she comes back to this horrible, dungy, gross, dusty Australian white town in search first of her crazy mother, played by Judy Davis, and her mother's living in a complete crap hole with, you know, so the first scene is she just has to put on a mask from the odor and clean the whole thing out. But in the process, what starts to happen is that one of the plot lines is that Kate Winslet had to leave when she was 10 because she allegedly, in a accident playing with a kid, broke his neck and killed him. So she was sent away. But as the plot evolves, the gay cross-dressing sheriff knew that she hadn't done it, but he didn't want to defend her because he was afraid of being outed. So he sent her off. The father of the boy who died, we now later find out, was in fact Kate Winslet's father, who never acknowledged it, that he had the kid with Kate Winslet's mother. So the very kid that she allegedly killed was in some way her illegitimate brother. But the story, and then she meets Liam Hemsworth, who plays this very sweet guy, and he falls in love with her, and he says, don't worry, I'm going to take care of you. And then he, in showing off something totally frivolous to tell her not to worry, he gets killed. Then there's all kinds of fights about another rival seamstress who really represents Christian repression, because Kate Winslet is bringing all these sexy dresses into Australia, and the other side brings her in to put these horrible high couture dresses on people with bows and frills, and nobody likes them, and everybody looks ugly. And so they all defect to Kate Winslet. But here's the punchline. In the end, Kate Winslet burns the whole town down. There's a lot of deaths. There's a lot of crazy stuff. There's a woman who kills her husband who had been abusing her and forcing her into alcohol. There's the gay policeman who finally outs himself and says, I did it, and I'm really, I want to apologize to you because I knew you didn't really. And it turns out that the kid who she thought she killed was a kid who was brutalizing her, and he put his head down, and he ran full speed against a barn, and all she did was move out of the way, and he cracked his head and died. So the murder that she allegedly committed, even by accident, never happened. She only moved away. All she did was get out of the way. Now, you must love me. I'm sorry, listeners of Voices from the Front Lines, to let me tell you these. No, I'm not on acid. I'm just telling you a film review. So what's the point, or why am I telling you this story? Because I think the film was an anti-imperialist film. I think the film was somebody in Australia trying to expose how grotesque and horrible white people are and how they treat each other. The absence of community, the sexual lies, the family lies, the guy who was her father was also having affairs and trying to seduce everybody while he drove his wife into alcoholism and she finally killed him. And it just shows that there is no community. There is no such thing as a white settler state community because the community is held together on stolen land. It's held together with an immoral, hypocritical Christianity. And I think the film is a terrific exposure of the pathos of white society. And it ends with Kate Winslet basically burning the whole little ugly town down. She gets back on the train and they say to her, "Where are you going now, ma'am?" And she says, "Paris." And the conductor says, "We don't go to Paris, we'll go to Melbourne." She said, "That'll do." And obviously she's going to take a plane from Melbourne to Paris. Not that Paris is any good, because Paris is another center of imperialist oppression. But we'll get to that in another.
She might be going to burn it down. You never know.
That's right. That's right. She might be going to burn Paris down. That's exactly right. But the point is that they say this is it's a lively, might be, when it's over, though, you may not be sure what exactly you just saw, which is why you need to listen to Voices from the Front Lines, because Eric Mann is going to tell you what you didn't even see, because most of you never watched this movie. So would I urge you to watch it? No. But it's worth watching. It's very, and Kate Winslet is a trip. Judy Davis is a trip. The two of them are phenomenal, as is the gentleman who plays the gay police chief is a trip. So thanks for listening. So what's the answer? Smash the white settler state. Smash Australia. All power to the Maoris. All power to the indigenous. All power to black people. And smash the U.S. white settler state as well. All right, G. Was that the greatest film review you ever heard? All right, now. Let's take a break. I don't know what the hell it was. But let's take a break. Let's hear some Quebrada, let's hear whatever they do, and I'm going to come back talking about looking in the mirror.
Is that Myrtle Dunnage? You grew up.
You got old. Myrtle Dunnage is back.
Haven't seen her since she was a kid. Wonder how she turned out.
She's back!
Mum, I need to remember the truth.
They say that she killed a boy.
So where did she go from here?
I worked in London, Milan, and Paris as a designer.
I reckon you came home for one of two things, revenge or me.
You can transform people.
That's very powerful. Use it.
Gertrude Pratt. The dance is Saturday night. I could make you something.
A dress can't change anything.
Watch and learn, Gert. Watch and learn. I can make you the most striking girl in the room. Take your clothes off.
A murderer and a lesbian.
Who is that?
Stunning.
I'd like to order some daywear.
Is that Dior?
I remember that day. He saw the whole thing.
I think Tilly understands my particular body shape.
She certainly does.
Go on, make them their dresses. Make them think they're classy.
They'll still hate you.
She murdered him. She's cursed.
They'll never forgive me.
Why didn't you tell me?
You're wasted here. I think we should run away together.
This is just a pack of lies!
I'm back, you bastards.
Stop her, Charger!
With what? Sitting?
You could be married in this suit. Snapped up by some eligible spinster or hag.
Trousers off, too?
Yes.
No. Thanks, Channing. That was the trio that we should have played in the beginning. One more thing I wanted to say is that there's a profound sadness inside the white psyche, inside what the film also mines or looks at is the terrible pain, which is not the primary issue, but all the lost souls that are suffering under white supremacy and white racism and the pathetic lives. It reminds me of the other book I read, Winesburg, Ohio. And the reason why I think this is important is some white people have seen this and have gotten out, have joined the civil rights movement, have joined the anti-war movement, have said, I don't want to be part of the white settler state. And that's the whole point of organizing is films like this, if we do expose them, the reason you expose them is so that you can see even inside yourself, getting back to looking in the mirror, oh, is there any part of me that is part of the white settler state? Mm. So I didn't convey that well enough, that the pathos of that entire town just reflects, not that I have great sympathy for the white oppressor nation, but within that, there are contradictions that a good organizer can, and from Martin Luther King to Malcolm X, interestingly, to, yes, Barack Obama, have been able to organize and get people to say, I'm not sure I want to be part of this culture anyway.
Yeah. You know, what that reminds me of, we were sitting down, I think this was last year or the year before, when we were watching Malcolm X's speech, The Field Negro versus the House Negro. And it was interesting because everyone gets the difference between the Field Negro and the House Negro. But it wasn't until you illuminated to me that Malcolm X was sitting there, and I think he said something like, you laugh now, or something like that, and you pointed out that, you know, he's really speaking to everyone to be introspective in the room, that you're laughing because you think the House Negro is so embarrassingly for the master, right? But what he's really trying to call you out and saying is, do you see the House Negro? I don't like saying that word. Do you see the House N-word inside of you yourself, right? It isn't just that it's those people over there and you're doing so much better that you just made this one mistake. And if you just make this little bit of improvement, you're going to be so much better, right? And so if that is the case, then why are we still fighting for our civil rights, right? Or why are we still fighting for the liberation of black people? And so that's what that reminds me of.
Well, cool. That was the voice of Channing Martinez. And the point being that a good filmmaker is supposed to get you at first. And that was really good, Channing. I mean, at first you laugh at all the other people, and then you say, wait a minute, is there any part of me inside of the character that I'm laughing at? And that's a very good segue to our Looking in the Mirror segment. Okay, so let me talk about Looking in the Mirror. The theme of the show, 818-985-5735, we're going to go to the phones in about, I'd say, 15 minutes, but you got to listen before you go to the phone so you know what you're going to talk about. The theme of the show is the issue of looking in the mirror and introspection. So let's start with who's not looking in the mirror, the Democratic Party to start with. I think Saturday Night Live is not looking in the mirror. I mean, they think they're so funny, making fun of Trump. Alec Baldwin plays a very caricature of Trump. Everybody laughs, ha ha ha, Trump. Then, what's her name, McCarthy plays Spicer that, you know, does a caricature. Except for one problem, Trump won. So how do you explain that? What's so funny about that? He's president. And you did that whole skit for 3, 4, 5, 6 months before the election. Everybody on Saturday Night Live laughed. And then there was this great character played by Kate McKinnon. Her name was Hillary Clinton. And Kate McKinnon played much more complexly. She played Hillary as a psychopath and as a person who has no internal moral clock, no internal anything. And so she plays her militant and then moderate, and she plays her anti-racist and pro-racist, and she shows her as a person who's just like trying on clothes, back to the dressmaker. And then there's this great scene in Saturday Night Live where Trump is, you know, saying terrible things about women, and he's saying terrible things about immigrants. And then the host says, Secretary Clinton, and she goes, No, it's okay. Let him keep talking. She goes, oh, my God, I'm going to win. Oh, my God, I'm going to win. Look how stupid he is. So in the skit, if you follow me, folks, Hillary Clinton wants Donald Trump to keep talking, to say more racist things. She doesn't want to take him on. She thinks he's so embarrassing that he's going to lose, and that's what she really thinks of this. She says, oh, my God, I'm going to win. Not because you want to vote for me, but because he's so unattractive that you're going to vote for me by comparison. And guess what, Hillary? No, you didn't get it. That's what Kate McKinnon was trying to show, that he is everything we thought he was, a racist, anti-immigrant, not just a male chauvinist, but a misanthrope, I think is the right word. Misogynistic, I'm sorry. He's all, misanthrope means you hate all people. Misogynistic means you hate women. He's all those things. Mm-hmm. But he's comprehensible. He's in his own crazy way authentic. Authentic, terrible. But Hillary couldn't figure out who she was because she was simply the face of raw ambition. And in the end, people voted against raw ambition in favor of somebody horrible. So that's what the Democrats. So then after they lost the election, this is back about looking in the mirror. I swear to God, I'm reading every article. I read a lot online. I get all these emails. Democrats are blaming Bernie.
They're blaming everyone.
Go ahead.
Just about everyone. I mean, they blame Bernie. Then they blame Putin. Then they blame Donald Trump. Then they blame the black Democrats. Then they blame the Latino Democrats. Then they blame the people on the left because you guys were too left. Then they blame the Greens. And I mean,
right,
everyone.
And it's like it really is everybody you mentioned. So the thing is, I'm reading all these articles, folks, and you know, online. I read Portside, which I really like. It's a left kind of a email newspaper, And I do read the New York Times online. I read MSNBC online, MSN.com. So anyway, here's the point. They really are blaming the millennials, the Democrats. They're blaming, I mean, it's like you can't look in the mirror and realize that you are a pro-corporate, somewhat racist party. You couldn't figure out, you took the black vote for granted, you took the Latino vote for granted. You didn't know how to talk to white people in an anti-racist way. All right, enough with the Democrats. Obviously, Trump, we'll get back to him, but the man, he does look in the mirror every minute. So he has no problem. I wouldn't say, Donald, you got to look in the mirror because that's where he lives. No, he doesn't see himself, but to the degree he sees himself, again, this is the guy who got elected president. 818-985-5735, Bernie. Bernie was the two people who were most successful were Bernie and Trump.
Yeah.
They were both authentic. Bernie is Bernie. He got up and said, I'm a socialist. What? I'm a socialist. He's not really a socialist. His version of socialism is, chamomile tea with honey. It's easy to take. It's a very soft. When they say, what do you mean by socialism? He says, free college tuition and paying back student loans. That's not socialism. But the point was that Bernie wanted to set an edge. he did set an edge, and he did a great job. He outperformed, as did Trump, and Hillary underperformed. But I think Bernie needs to look in the mirror about the issue of race again, and I don't think Bernie knows how to really say the black word or the Latino word. He certainly doesn't know how to talk about racism. He comes from an all-white state, which is Vermont, a virtually all-white state. So every time I listen to Bernie, he goes, and the American people, and the American people, and the American people. I get it, Bernie. You can't ever say black people have special problems. It wasn't the reason he lost. I mean, he lost because he was sabotaged by the Clinton people through all the broken rules. And I think it's pretty well assumed that he at least had a good fighting shot to take on Trump and would have done much better than Hillary. Yes. Yeah. 818-985-5735. So I think Bernie needs to look in the mirror on the issue of race, is my point. I think Jill Stein, who did many very, very fine things, I think she did run and outperform her own campaign in many ways, but Jill would not take on the Greens in Los Angeles, who, in my opinion, are deeply chauvinist, including Mike Feinstein. And they supported Measure M, which was a racist, regressive sales tax for the MTA. We met with Jill, we being Channing Martinez and I. And Jill said, I will take a stand against Measure M. She said, but where are the LA Greens on this? I said, the LA Greens are for this. She said, I'm going to take them on. And she never did. She made one statement, but she was supposed to work with the Strategy Center. She was supposed to work with us to work out a flyer. I wrote a flyer quoting her, but I wouldn't put it out, of course, until she authorized the flyer. And she wouldn't do it. So, yes, Joe, I hold you responsible. I think you need to look in the mirror on why you made a promise and you broke a serious campaign promise. Overall, she did some very, very good things. And I think her call for a recount was absolutely right, as I totally disagree with saying Joe should not have called for a recount because she was trying to help Hillary. Well, obviously, in some way, we would have helped Hillary. Joe wasn't going to get elected president. But the Greens have every right to fight for democratic rights and to say, if they think there's voter fraud, that it was a good thing she did. And it did get some money to the Green Party, and she did play an important role in the post-election fight for democracy. I totally disagree with those who said Joe should have stayed out of this. I think that was a good thing that she did. But I think she's got to still look in the mirror, because we really needed her help to defeat Measure M, and now the MTA has $2 billion more dollars to attack black people with. All right, now me looking in my own mirror, 818-985-5735. How are you looking in your own mirror, folk? Remember, don't get on the phone and tell me what's wrong with Bernie. You can tell me what's wrong with me. How's that? But I'd rather you say what's wrong with yourself. So I'm going to start with my own self, okay? Hey, all right. Mistakes I've made. I think I should have moved back into the black community 5 or 10 years ago. My organization, the Labor Community Strategy Center, is a wonderful organization. It's a black, Latino, Korean, multiracial organization. It's always had a very good position on black liberation. It's also had a strong black membership. We've had a strong Latino membership. We've written an article called Reconstructing Los Angeles from the Bottom Up. But I think that I got stuck on the top floor of a big, very nice Art Deco building in Koreatown. And I didn't get back down on the ground. And on the ground is where I come from. I come from a community organizing base. I also come from, this is Eric Mann on Voices from the Front Lines. I also worked 10 years on an auto assembly line. And that's when I was at my best. That was when I was finding my own soul. So my self-criticism is that I should have moved the organization more directly into an oppressed nationality community, in particular the black community. I'm very happy that we've opened up Strategy and Soul on the corner of King and Crenshaw. You can call us at 213-387-2800 because we're still trying to figure out the phones over there. And if you're interested in getting involved in the movement, which I'll tell you about, So that's one self-criticism I have. Second is what? I think I should have figured out more what to do about the national elections. And now my self-criticism, I'm trying to figure out what to do about Trump. Self-critical, meaning I am trying to solve that. But let me tell you my dilemma on this, because this is, you could say, not a, a true self-criticism as much as a quandary. One reason I don't know what to do is because most of the anti-Trump activity is being organized by the Democrats. And I don't want to be, I don't mind being in a united front with the Democrats. I don't want to be part of the Democratic Party. So when I see Elizabeth Warren putting out stuff on Move On, if I see Robert Reich putting on stuff on Move On, we must stand up to Trump. I think for 8 years you didn't stand up to these policies when Obama was carrying them out. So it's hard for me to just say that the way I'm going to stand up to Trump is to just become essentially an appendage to the Democratic Party, given all the fights we're having in L.A. So that's a dilemma, a contradiction. Now, the most positive thing developing, and again, our brother Manuel Criollo was going back to this, the next round of these immigrant rights meetings, and I'll find out what then. It's not an open meeting, but there are immigrant rights groups that are trying to make essentially, they have looked in the mirror. They're making a self-criticism, which is they have felt, and these are mainly Latino groups, that they haven't grasped the depth of the attacks on black people. And they have focused on the immigrant experience and not on the genocidal experience of people who were brought here as slaves. And so there's a segment of the immigrant rights movement that's trying to say, if we're going to build a sanctuary city, that sanctuary city cannot be a sanctuary for Latinos at a time when black people are being driven out of the city. So they have gone through an introspection and come out on the other side better, right? Oh, here's another one. I feel like I did a lot of good work around film reviews, but I didn't do a lot of good work around film showing. So now the strategy in Seoul, which is again on King and Crenshaw, we showed at the opening of our event, we showed the Battle of Algiers. We just showed Selma. So I'm going to move from film criticism to film showing. The other self-criticism is I've put on too much weight, and my corrective is I'm on a terrific diet. I'm having a great time, and after I hit my goal weight, I'll tell you all about it. But the main point of introspection and self-criticism is correction and improvement. I mean, I used to get very down on myself. I luckily, I'm at least most of the time, I don't have that response. But you got to look in the mirror every day and say, what mistakes did I make yesterday? What are the areas of improvement I want to make? And I'm saying, so my areas of improvement are paying more attention to the black community, which is positive, paying more attention to film, which is positive, paying more attention to the Black Latino Alliance, in particular through the intersection of immigrant rights and other things, and also focusing more on stopping MTA genocide against the black nation. Those are correctives that came out of self-criticism. All right, 818-985-5735. Remember, if you get up and say, this is what's wrong with Donald Trump, I'm going to cut you off. If you get up and say, this is what's wrong with the Democrats, I'm asking you, what is wrong with your work? What improvements have you made? A correction? Have you made a self-criticism? That's what I want to hear. All right, let's hear it. All right, Zoe and Gardena, how you doing, Zoe? How you doing?
Man, at this moment, I'm illuminated. My reflection in the mirror has shown me that self-medicating through alcohol and is a hindrance to who I am. The dilemma I face the realization I have is that the connection between evolution and revolution. I was blessed to have met Didon Kamati and George Quant, who have both become part of the KPF family, and the lesson I learned that spirituality allows us to look in the mirror and find the courage to as the person says on the air, to find your own truth. And I think that in this time, that question is so profound because as we are at the point of evolution, our enemy has already built the prisons. So many of the things that we face, we may be behind the game. However, as Martin Luther King says, the arc of the universe swings toward justice. So as I realize that, as I draw closer to the essence of my own spirituality, in that quietness, answers arrive, because actually that's what the Creator wanted in the first place. But through getting high and drinking, or actually just being a coward from the standpoint of when you connect the dots, it's like, oh, my God, you know. However, we are not a people that are cowards in the practice of who our ancestors were, who the Indians' ancestors, the Tibetans, the Asians, the Africans, black people, builders of pyramids and culture and so on and so forth. What got in my way was that in my getting high and stuff and drinking or whatever, I fell away from joining organizations like yours. Being a graduate of Dorsey High School, I was surrounded at that point in Crenshaw with many powerful people who were doing magnificent things. But if you're not going to the classes, if you're not aligning or committing yourself to the movers and the shakers, then, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, let me respond, brother. I think what you said was very beautiful, and thank you, and I mean that. I've been have an interesting journey with alcohol. I mean, I don't think I was ever – well, I shouldn't say – you know, you always say you weren't. I was a person with a drinking problem. Whether I was an alcoholic, I was way interested in alcohol. I would end my night. I would I would be at a meeting.
I would start my day.
I would – oh, yeah, you start your day. I would be at a meeting, and I would think, I can't wait to get home and have a drink. And I – gave up alcohol. I mean, maybe I have to make the decision to just give it up. There's part of me that still keeps that option open, but I haven't had a drink in 3 or 4 months. I don't basically drink. And I used to have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 drinks, you know, but certainly the 2, that was my number. I like 2. So my point, I'm going to have to move on, but let me say this, what you're right about is that whether it's my food problem or my alcohol problem, the self-medication issue is very deep, and we're lonely, we're sad, we're depressed, and alcohol plays a role, but you have, you know, a momentary role, but it's pretty exciting because I think, and I'd love, brother, I'd like to keep the, I'm going to go to another call, but let me say this. I think one reason we don't like to give up the alcohol is back to looking in the mirror, right? I mean, without the alcohol, you may not like what you see very much, and that's going to force you. So the giving up of the alcohol is only the first step to looking in the mirror and saying, now what do I do?
Right.
And I totally support what you said about preventing you from being part of the movement. If you call us at 213-387-2800 and give your name to the organ. 387-2800 is the strategy center. If you call, I promise I'll call you back. Leave your name, and I will personally call you back. Is that a deal?
Magnificent.
All right. Thank you so much. Can we go to the next caller, please? Ed from Los Angeles. Are you looking in the mirror, Ed?
Yeah. I'm 84 years old. I've been married to an African-American woman, a wonderful woman, over 57 years. I grew up in the Bronx in New York in the time when there was like the American Labor Party. I was a member of the Young Progressives. At 15, I got to go to the Henry Wallace Convention in Cleveland.
Wow.
And I was an usher, and I got a picture with Henry Wallace that I've always been proud of, and then I came out here.
And that was 1948, listeners. Go ahead.
Yeah. And then came out here. I had gone to CCNY for 2 years. I went to UCLA and got involved. I got married. I had a family. I, you know, did all the things that people do. I voted Democratic, because I was always voting against the other person. And now at 84, I look around, I look at my kids, I always figured, you know, they'll turn out great just by example, because my wife was very active in the NAACP, and we were active in the integration project. She worked for the Judge Eagley on a monitoring committee to monitor compliance with the school district. And I always said my claim to fame was that I was Dorothy's husband. Anyway, she got ill. She's been in long-term care for 6 years. And I start looking at, you know, what have I done? And I think about my kids. And I realize I found this picture of me with Henry Wallace. And I showed it to my kids, and they said, "Who's Henry Wallace?" And I realized I was who I was because my parents, you know, grew up in the garment industry. They were unionists. They were activists. And, you know, that was the way I grew up, whereas my kids grew up in a pretty middle-class sort of home. I mean, we were different because we were an interracial couple. But, I mean, I never really did for them what my parents did for me. And I come to realize that, and so the only thing I can do now is I'm collecting videos and books and things for them to leave to my kids and grandkids. We have 8 grandkids and 4 great-grandkids, so I'm trying to leave them at least like a library saying, you know, this is what your grandpa was like. But I really regret not being, you know, the kind of parent or the kind of parent that my parents were. So that's it.
It's very beautiful. I mean, let me say this. Are you a Jew?
Isn't everyone?
Well, you sound like
Cousin Bernie.
All right.
I assume you're from New York, too.
All right. Well, I am. And you, look, it sounds like you've had a pretty wonderful life and you still got a lot ahead of you. I think that what you're doing is beautiful. I've gone through remorse. I know the word regret. I know the word remorse. It's terrible. You don't need it. You've done a beautiful job with your life. But you're right. You got work to do. You got to get this act together. You got to get those. The kids will listen. I mean, for you to have been with Henry Wallace, and they will listen to you. And I think getting these pictures together, building these legacies for your children and grandchildren, maybe you should have done more, but you have a lot of work to do now. Again, if you want to leave your number either at Eric at Voices from the Front Lines, I will call you back, or 213-387-2800. So far, the first two people called it tremendously beautiful, and you're doing great, and you still got to, you know, just keep taking good care of yourself and carry the project out, okay? And we'll stay in touch.
All right. Great.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry. Is this Wendy? This is Looking in the Mirror. Do we have Wendy in Ventura?
Looking in the Mirror.
Hello. Who's this, please?
This is Wendy.
Hi, Wendy in Ventura. Hi. What? You're looking in the mirror, what do you see, and what do you want to change?
Okay, am I on the air?
You're on the air with Eric Mann on Voices from the Front Lines.
Okay. Well, you had first invited us to say a couple things to you.
Yeah, whatever you want to say to me, sure.
I was going to say that I feel that a lot, not just you, but a lot of people on the station are very caught up in misogyny. I think that's why you had a hard time putting out that word. But, you know, it's so much so that it's kind of imbued everybody. I don't think anybody even realizes where they are anymore. And they go around calling ma'am and Mrs. instead of Ms. now, and it's gone so far backwards. And I wish people were paying more attention to that. But nevertheless, I really liked the guy that called last. I liked how he was thinking. And I liked almost your life as art there, where you just got in there and kind of, you know, laid all these things out and opened up your heart. I just was very impressed with that approach. And I guess on my looking mirror, I'm doing this horrible project at home that I've dropped out of the world as far as you know, kind of given up hope after this election for a while just because they have to do this other thing. Even if things had been great, I would have had to do this project, had no choice. But I do want to get back to the things that I was working on, which is, you know, for women to get elected into offices and for, you know, women to have equal access to things and equal, you know, weighting our views equally to men and be treated as full humans. So, and also the, I mean, a group that helps us trying to keep our right to choose over our own bodies. But anyway, I do enjoy your program. I really, what I want to do is to improve myself. I want to pay attention to some program I heard earlier. They were talking about the, you know, the letters, and it was the fellow from Letters and Politics from out of KPFA. And he was talking about the Mongols and the and Genghis Khan and the Huns and the Tartars. And I thought, I've been thinking because of Gerald Horn being on your show, on your other program,
right.
He's been telling about where we really have gotten our culture from. And it is from the Black nations. It is from Africa. It is from the Middle East. Or it's called the Middle East. I guess that's an inappropriate way of calling it. But,
well, thanks a lot. Why don't you just tie up because we have a couple more minutes and so the main thing you're going to look in the mirror and change is that you want to spend more time on women in politics. Is that right? And you've been involved in some personal stuff, but you want to make sure you give that more attention?
Yeah, so what I was doing on that was even more reason to do so.
Okay, thanks a lot. I just want to say in terms of the culture of humans and words that if I say that Donald Trump is a misanthrope, which means he hates all people, and then I say he's a misogynist, it doesn't mean I don't think about Donald Trump's hatred of women. You know, it's not like I used a word that was a positive word. Those two words go hand in hand, and just think it's important in the movement to be careful. I mean, if somebody says something really wrong and hateful, call them on it, but it certainly doesn't mean if I call them both a misanthrope and a misogynist that I don't care about the oppression of women. So with that, Channing Martinez, what are you looking in the mirror and what are you seeing and what are the changes you want to make?
Well, you know, this past week I went to the HBCU Climate Change Conference.
What does HBCU stand for?
Historically Black Colleges and University Climate Conference held at Dillard University. And, you know, for me, that was a very, very, very transformative trip because I went and I knew we prepared, but when I got there, I had to be the one to initiate a actual announcement about the Strategy Center doing internships, and I had to be the one to, you know, do these interviews, and me being the shyest person in the world, I was sort of shaking. I'm not gonna lie. I was like, oh boy. I have to be like the face of the organization right now. Oh my gosh. And so, you know, it wasn't until you called me on that, whenever you called me, Thursday, I think, that it really shook me up. And I, as my own judgment, was like, what am I doing? I've been organizing for so long. Why am I so nervous? And so that is one thing I'm still working on, is really breaking out of my own shyness and, like, my own, you know, I guess self-pity of, like, me doubting myself on whether I can actually do things that I know I probably can do if I just get out of my own way. Anyways.
Well, what's happening, what you're listening to, is obviously, if everybody knows by now, Channing and I work very closely together, and that was the voice of Channing Martinez. And as he was saying, he went down to represent, and I think you're such a powerful person. You know, I work with you every day, and in our relationship, you're very powerful. You're not afraid. You know, you have strong opinions. But you're right. Getting out of your own way, or looking in the mirror and seeing you know, we all have demons. We have things that, I mean, I'm more aggressive publicly, but then me and Manuel we have the demon of, oh God, I want to call you, I think I made a mistake, or you know, let me tell you what I think I did wrong. And then we go through it, and sometimes you did do something wrong. But I think the willingness to lead, you have to understand that it's not that you have a personality need to lead, but we need you to lead. So you have to overcome whatever personal phobias you have, in because we need you to lead. You're a young black man who's, and yes, as you say, a young queer Garifuna black man, and we need you to lead.
Yeah.
And Nina Simone had many demons, but never, ever a fear of leading. She did it her way, as I do it my way. I love Nina Simone in the beginning. She comes the sun, and then I love her at the end because we did it her way. This is Eric Mann. I want to thank, beyond what I can express, this. I think we may do the look in the mirror. God, we stumbled on something rather amazing. For the brother that talked about his alcoholism, for the brother who talked about him missing his beautiful black wife and what he wants to do at 84, for the sister that wants to do more work, and for G, who's telling me to get the heck out of here, all power to the people. See you next week. This is Eric Mann. I'll see you Tuesday at 3. And remember, Feminist Magazine is on before us every Tuesday at 2. Take good care of yourself. Without exemption, I will hand each chart.